Hello, and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we look at First Nations issues from two perspectives. We talk to a couple of Brock professors on the matter, Political Science Assistant Professor Jeannique Dubois and Sakoyeta Widrick, a lecturer with the Tecumseh Center for Aboriginal Research and Education. And a full-day conference is coming up this Saturday at Rodman Hall Arts Center titled Public Space, Urban Crisis. We'll find out more from a Brock Professor of Political Science, Leah Bradshaw, later in the hour. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, James Anaya, was in Canada for the past week meeting with the Canadian government and visiting communities across the country to hear the concerns of First Nations peoples. Canada endorsed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2010. We were joined in the studio recently by Brock Political Science Assistant Professor Jeannique Dubois, and we discussed the First Nation question. I asked first what she took from the visit to Canada by Mr. Anaya.
Well, we've been expecting Mr. Anaya for some time now, and he's been here for a few days or almost over a week at this point. And what he's been able to do is talk to members of First Nations, Métis, Inuit communities, and be able to assess what they take as being the primary issues and concerns.
Would you consider this an indication in any way the UN is concerned with the way Canada treats First Nations peoples in the country?
I think the UN is always observing and concerned about First Nations people, Indigenous people, across the world. Mr. Anaya's visit is one opportunity for the UN to assess what's going on in Canada, but it's also an opportunity for Canada to do an assessment of its own treatment of Indigenous peoples.
There was a suggestion that his visit might be considered meddling in Canadian affairs. Would that be an assessment you would agree with, or is that not the case?
Not at all. I think that the Canadian government, just like other governments across the world, use the UN and use these opportunities provided by UN special rapporteurs to take an account of the situation and see whether they're measuring up to the commitments that they've made. And I think that's an important resource that Indigenous peoples can use as well in terms of advocacy, in terms of relationships amongst themselves with other groups, to use this as a resource to see what more can be done and what's being done already.
What, in your mind, are the First Nations concerns that should be addressed by the Canadian government that haven't properly been addressed so far?
I'm perhaps not the best person to identify those concerns. I think communities have been identifying those concerns and voicing them. I think Chief Atleo has been very vocal in identifying the need to address the issue of murdered and missing Aboriginal women. I think the other levels of government, both Métis and Inuit, have been identifying the need for consultation and real engagement with communities. So I think that communities themselves have identified what the issues are. They include First Nations education, they include First Nations health, they also include Métis economic development, they also include Inuit outcomes for health and education. So I think across the board, communities have been voicing what their concerns are.
The Royal Proclamation of 1763 set out a lot of the treaty rights to be observed in Canada even to this day. Now, as Canadians, are we holding up our end of the bargain as far as the treaty rights are concerned?
That's a really good question. And I think the Royal Proclamation and its celebration last Monday was a sort of an opportunity for us to think back as whether we as Canadians are engaging in this treaty relationships. The motto of treaties that's been adopted recently that we might have heard or that we might have heard in the community is that we are all treaty people. We as Canadians, whether we're First Nations or not First Nations, we're bound by this treaty relationship. And I think having people engaged in that relationship is part of the Royal Proclamation. And I think by seeing the protests that were being carried out across the country, we noticed that, in fact, a lot of people aren't thinking that we're holding up that end of the bargain.
Is there a reluctance, do you think, to honor those treaty rights as they could be considered outdated in today's society?
I'm not sure if it's as much a question of outdated as misunderstood. I think there's a lot of Canadians Americans who don't understand treaties. How many of us have really read treaties, or how many of us have read the Proclamation of 1763 or the Treaty of Niagara of 1764 that followed? I think these are living documents. These are ongoing documents, and I think they still are very valid. They're not outdated, but I think they're definitely misunderstood.
Yeah, I think there may be a perception with some people that every law, every set of laws can be like a living being. You change them, they evolve to adjust to present-day situations. And I guess for some people, they may look at them and say, that was 1763. A lot has changed since then, and yet the treaty rights haven't changed. Perhaps it's time to look at them again.
The proclamation and a lot of the treaties, they didn't write out specifically how it would work in practice, the details, the minute ideas of how they would hunt, where they would hunt. They just laid out the principles. They laid out the principles of coexistence that we would negotiate. In the proclamation, the King George III said, of course, we're going to negotiate. We recognize that Indigenous peoples are sovereign on this land and that we need their consent in order to move forward, in order to develop our colonies. And so I think those principles, we need to go back to those principles and understand them. And of course, use those principles to interpret how it is that we're going to carry out treaty rights. Where should people hunt? How should they hunt? How should they live on reserves, off reserves, amongst other groups? So I think that needs to be informed by those principles that are expressed in the treaties.
Okay, now as far as the hunting is concerned, since we brought that up, not talking specifically about the Short Hills deer hunt that happened last winter and will be happening again, there's a perception, I suppose, with some that in a case like that, using that as an example, why does it need to go on in this day and age? That's an aspect of the treaty rights that I think perhaps is more than anything else misunderstood and needs to be elaborated upon and explained so that both sides understand the situation and where each side is coming from.
I think that's right. I think that there is a need for more comprehension on all sides. But when we say sides, it's unclear what we mean, right? Is it between the federal and the provincial and First Nations government? Is it between federal, provincial, and Métis governments? Is it amongst citizens that are always sort of feeling the conflicts of overland and use of resources? So I think there's a need for a more general conversation about why it is that groups are claiming rights. Why is it that the hunt is so important to the way of life of Indigenous peoples? And how should governments react to that? Not only the federal government, provincial governments, and in many cases, municipal governments.
As far as the governments are concerned, how would you term the relationship between First Nations peoples and the provincial and the federal government? Is it improving? Has it been more strained than it should be? What's that balance there like these days?
Isn't that always the tough question? Definitely, I think we've seen a lot of great initiatives come out of negotiations. And I think that it often depends on where we're talking about, because Canada has many, many First Nations people, a number of Métis communities and Inuit communities who all negotiate with their territorial, provincial, and with the federal government. And I think in different areas, there's been more success. Here in Ontario, we have very strong Indigenous leaders who have been negotiating with the federal government. But I think part of that, the key to moving that relationship forward, is to make sure that we have all levels of government at that table. And that means having provincial governments involved and ready to engage with Indigenous peoples across the board.
Now, when you talk about the Assembly of First Nations, there's also the Métis National Council and the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples. What's the relationship between all three of these entities?
I don't know how I would characterize their relationship. I think each of the national organizations carry out an important role insofar as they try to represent as best they can the interests of those groups that fall within their jurisdiction, as we might understand jurisdiction. So the Métis National Council advocates on behalf of all the Métis in Canada as part of the Métis Nation. And the Assembly of First Nations advocates on behalf of all the First Nations. But each of these groups have their own levels of government. So the Métis Nation will have the Métis Nation Saskatchewan that has their elected bodies. The Manitoba Métis Federation has their elected bodies. And First Nations have both local, sometimes treaty level, sometimes tribal level. So they have a number of different levels of governance. And I think that what this particular time in our history recalls is that each individual nation is the one that we have a relationship with as a country. So Canada needs to engage individually with those nations. It's a nation-to-nation relationships, and so they can't go strictly to the Congress or to the AFN or to the Métis National Council. And that's really hard to do because there's a lot of groups, and somehow the federal government and provincial governments still have to engage with those groups.
But is that engagement a priority? Does it appear to be a priority as far as the governments are concerned?
But I think we're going to have an answer to that question very shortly following the throne speech, how the government will carry out the commitments that it makes in the throne speech and whether there's any real weight that comes through with that. I think we're going to have to wait in the coming months to see. But definitely, it's on the political agenda, both at the level of governments, but I think also at the level of the general public.
As far as the Métis-related issues are concerned, are there any issues to be dealt with that would be totally different from First Nations issues?
Absolutely. The Métis, unlike First Nations, didn't have the same relationship with the Crown. The Proclamation of 1763 doesn't really apply to the Métis in the same way. It does insofar as we're talking about a relationship, but the Métis negotiated their existence in Canada through political agreements with the government, and the government hasn't lived up to those agreements. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that. And so at this point, we're waiting to see how that will move forward. What kind of rights are the Métis entitled to? They're very different than First Nations people. And in Canada, I think we tend to conflate all our Aboriginal groups together. Aboriginal groups include the Inuit, the Métis, and the First Nations. And within those groups, there's also a lot of communities to be mindful of. And so I think the Métis have a very different political agenda, but fundamentally, they share with First Nations and the Inuit the desire to develop a stronger relationship with the federal and provincial governments and to live more full lives.
So that would be the same with the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples as well. Again, different. We can't group them all in the same way.
Yeah, the Congress for Aboriginal Peoples plays an important role insofar as it represents a lot of those people who don't fall into the categories that the state recognizes. So non-status, people who are in urban centers, people who aren't, their jurisdiction is unclear according to the way that the government defines who is and who isn't Indian for the purposes of rights under the Indian Act. And so they have a very difficult mandate, and what they've been trying to do is really advocate for rights in urban settings for Indigenous peoples. And that's a really big challenge because they don't necessarily have an interlocutor with whom to negotiate because neither the federal nor the provincial government really acknowledges any obligation towards those groups, precisely because they're not part of the jurisdictions that we identify within state categories. So I think that moving beyond categories and thinking more generally about what kind of life do we want for Canadians, whether they're First Nations, Inuit, Métis, whether they live in urban areas on reserves or in rural areas, and having that as the foundation for moving forward with programs, with services, with rights, with economic development opportunities, and all other opportunities that might present themselves.
Now, on the subject of programs and services, I was reading the Globe and Mail article this week on the educational divide, if you will, between Canadians and First Nations, many of whom in the First Nations communities don't even benefit from a high school education, which I think most people would be aware of the problem that has developed over the years, but perhaps not aware of the seriousness of the problem. The good side of that is a lot of the First Nations people are making the effort to not just get that high school education, but when the opportunity presents itself, to go beyond that, get a university education, college education, what have you, and better themselves. What can we do as a country to lessen that divide, to close the gap so that everyone is benefiting from the basic high school education that we all would expect to receive to begin with?
I think we need to listen. It's very simple. I think we need to listen to what communities are asking for and what they're saying. First Nations communities have been very clear in the discussions around First Nations education about what their needs are. And that includes having curriculums that are developed by an Indigenous people, by First Nations themselves. It means having First Nations people run their own school boards, having the ability to manage and control. It also means getting away from caps of 2% annual increase of funding by the federal government and really looking at what are the needs, what are the financial needs, and how we're going to meet those through financial agreements. And so I think if we listen to communities, we would see the results that we want. And I think that if we're actually listening and we're responding, we'll be better off, not only in education, but in all aspects.
The First Nations peoples, a lot of them, when they're on a reservation, would be in a more remote or rural area. Would that be a problem that would be harder to address as far as the education is concerned?
I think there's always challenges, but a lot of people live in rural areas in Canada, and we've managed to find a way to meet their education needs. Not in all situations, but in most situations, I think we do a fairly good job outside of First Nations education. The real problem in the area of First Nations education in rural areas is how the government accounts for funding, infrastructure, and delivery of services and programs. And we need to get away from those categories, and we need really to have a much larger level conversation about how are we going to address this. And I don't think that that is something that the government can do on its own by developing a program or an approach or an act. What it needs to do is work with communities and see what are your needs. Who are you willing to work with in terms of having larger schools if the community is too small? Where are the teachers going to come from? What kind of transportation collaboration might be possible? Communities are already having those conversations, and I think if we listen, we'll see some really great ideas how to actually deliver education to rural communities and reserve communities.
So listening is the beginning of it all.
That's right.
Thank you, Professor Dubois, for coming in today.
My pleasure.
That was Brock Political Science Assistant Professor Yannick Dubois on the visit to Canada by James Anaya of the UN to look at concerns of First Nations communities in the country. You're listening to Inquisitive Minds, a presentation of Brock Radio, CFBU FM. We continue our discussion of First Nations issues on this edition of Inquisitive Minds in light of the visit to Canada over the past week by UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, James Anaya. Not surprisingly, many issues concerning First Nations peoples were brought up during Anaya's visit, and to discuss some of those issues, we were joined in the CFBU-FM studios recently by Sakoyeta Widrick, a lecturer with the Tecumseh Center for Aboriginal Research and Education, as well as a cultural awareness educator and traditionalist belonging to the Mohawk Wolf Clan. Mr. Widrick, welcome.
Sego, skanakowa.
Let's start with the meetings held with Mr. Anaya. What do you think has been accomplished in the meetings?
Well, first of all, he's a gentleman that has come here, and my understanding from paying attention to the news is that the Prime Minister has not really been overly enthusiastic about him coming to discuss things with Aboriginal peoples. One of the things that I believe he will be doing is, again, just kind of I've always believed that in order to make progress with our children or anybody, we need to be consistent as well as repetitious in that consistency with the type of message we give. One of the things that we found with the government of Canada going back a long time ago, back to the Royal Proclamation of 1763 with the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and now with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, everything that we present to the government is consistent, but we have to continue to be repetitious because whoever is in power doesn't seem to want to listen. They don't want to seem to have any part of it. They begin to look at these are things that happened in the past, they should be left in the past, and they should not be brought up by our people. One of the things that I noticed during the 9/11 remembrance was there were all these posters and all these things on the internet saying, never forget. And in the Indian community, we found that somewhat humorous. Yes, here's a thing that happened, it was terrible, but we're told never forget. There was an American Holocaust, North American Holocaust, in which 100 million Aboriginal people were killed. We still live with the direct results of a lot of that type of mentality, that type of treatment, but we're told, why don't you leave it alone and forget it and get over it and go on and work things out today to where Canada can be the best it can be, kind of like the Army slogan, be all you can be. Well, how can we be if a lot of these things that form the basic groundwork of a Canadian multicultural society have been dishonored, especially for the individuals who were the direct descendants of the people who were the first occupiers of this land base.
Now, you referred to the Prime Minister. What's the deal with the government? They are not too thrilled about the ongoing discussions. What's the problem?
We've realized for a long time that Canada is not interested in fulfilling promises that were, again, made with originally the British Crown in regards to the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, or Royal Commission, excuse me, this Royal Agreement of 1763, that Canada has consistently, parts of that agreement were eventually towards the development of Aboriginal inherent right and title. And that meant as well as occupancy and being able to look after the administration of our own territories, lands, and resources, it also meant the reestablishment of a system of self-governance. And Canada has consistently walked away from honoring that commitment that was made such a long time ago by King George III and then eventually passed over to Canada to continue to honor the agreements that King George had made with the Aboriginal peoples on this continent. And so in the development of Canada, we have seen that Aboriginal people have consistently been denied equal access to very basic things that most Canadians enjoy, and much of it at our expense. rights. And so what we've continued to do is repetitiously approach the government and try to speak in a good way that these are issues that need to be finalized. They need to have these issues brought forward so that healing can take place, so that we can begin to work at creating a country that is based on what we believe was the original Treaty of North America, the Deganijo Hadi Kaswenta, the Turo Wampum Belt, that said there is the original people of this land and there are the newcomers who come here. We both have our ways. We both have our own systems of governance. We have our own foods. We have our own worldview, and these are to be traveled together side by side in peace, mutual respect, and friendship all the days that we live upon this land. And we have found Canada to consistently walk away from this in whatever area that we present to the Canadian government to address. A good example of this is it wasn't that long ago where Prime Minister Stephen Harper publicly made an announcement that Canada does not have a history of colonization, and Canada's only history is one of colonization of the Aboriginal people and peoples of this land.
So treaty rights will be the main area of concern for First Nations people, I presume, at this point in time.
One of the first things I think is there's been a big misunderstanding of how treaty rights should be identified. A right, spelled R-I-G-H-T, is something that somebody has. It's something that is given to them or that they inherently have that allows them to do something. The way I was brought up and taught that if we have hunting rights, and we spell that R-I-T-E-S, it includes a heck of a lot more geography than just a right, R-I-G-H-T. That means that if we're going to hunt deer, we also have to be looking at the preservation of the deer. We also have to be looking at the environmental context of what the deer need to survive, what they need to be healthy, what they need to be able to reproduce, how they need to be harvested, how we need to treat them in all aspects and manners with not only our hunting but preparing the deer for food, as well as making sure that the deer are able to exist in their environment without encroachment that's inappropriate. So a fishing right is the same thing. How do we take care of our fishing stocks? Anybody has a right to go down and throw a line in the water, but that right doesn't mean that they're honoring a right if it's spelled R-I-T-E. R-I-T-E means we look after the fish stocks. We make sure that we're not overfishing. It makes sure that people that are accessing that right do so in an appropriate, respectful manner. So treaty rights are more or less the same thing. And one of the things that I believe firmly is Canada, a lot of people believe that Canada as a country right now exists because it bought everything from the Indians. And the treaties, basically, according to our people's understanding, were agreements that allowed access. Because if you speak to our people, one of the major, major cultural differences you will find is that nobody has the right to own the earth. These are areas that are given to us for possession, for us to take hold of and to look after and take care of. But they are ours to allow others access to those areas. Canada is basically made up of a series of numbered treaties. Those numbered treaties are the same as what you and I would find if we went to the bank for a mortgage. We could pay for 23 years on a 25-year mortgage and then decide the last 2 years we've paid enough, we're not going to pay anymore. What's the bank going to do? It's going to come and repossess what it is that you got from the mortgage in the first place. So we look at the treaties that we have with Canada and we say in many, many areas, Canada has not fulfilled those obligations. Now, the Vienna Treaty, Vienna Convention of 1969, was an international signing agreement by the countries of the world that basically stipulates the way these countries are supposed to work with indigenous territories and nations, that if through that process of treaty making, these treaties have not been fulfilled, that those treaties are found to be lacking in any way, shape, or form, the Indian nations now have the right to say those agreements have not been fulfilled, payments have not been made, those treaties are null and void, and everything returns to pre-treaty status. So then technically, if that happens, where is Canada? Canada as a country basically does not exist if the occupants of those numbered treaty areas say you have not fulfilled your obligations, and according to this international treaty, we have a right to say it's null and void, everything returns to pre-treaty status, it's all Indian land again.
Now, you touched on the deer hunt. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I want to zero in, since we've got the opportunity here to talk about it, the deer hunt in Short Hills Park, just south of us here. There was one last winter. It raised the ire of a lot of people, and I suspect it will again. What is your position on this? Because I suspect a lot of the people locally are not fully grasping the entire story here. They're only seeing one side of it. They're not seeing both sides.
Mm-hmm. That's a discussion that, once again, I keep referring to the Royal Proclamation. There, I got it right this time. Royal Proclamation of 1763. Because it's right in the Royal Proclamation of 1763 that King George, when he transferred powers over to Canada, there was an understanding that Aboriginal people would have that right in their territories, as well as territories that were claimed by the Queen, to turn around and be able to hunt and fish and use the resources of those territories without interruption from the government that was in existence at that time, which was the British powers. But then later on, Canada came to fulfill that. So when we talk about this Royal Proclamation of 1763, many people look at the date and they say 1763, that happened a long time ago. What relevance does it have it today? And our elders say, well, it has a lot of relevance, because even right now today, as we're settling some of these land claims, and I want to specify, I hear all the time that these are Indian land claims. The reality is that our people follow and believe is that these are Indian lands that are being claimed by Canada. So they are Canadian land claims. They are not Indian land claims. It is only our people asserting what it is that we already hold on to and look after and take care of, and Canada is wanting part of that. So what type of an agreement can we make where both benefit? So this proclamation of 1763 still has relevance today, because we have quite a few areas in Canada that are still unceded, have never been sold, have never been given away, and yet Canada claims access to those resources. BC is a good example. Not long ago, I had a chance to look at this one community in Korea that every house in there is built out of log cabins of red cedar that come from BC. And it's Canadian people that have these businesses where they are making fantastic amounts of money off BC red cedar, and yet these areas where they're taking cedar from have never been sold to Canada. They've never been ceded. They still belong to Indian people who are not, by any chance, because they have not made treaties with Canada, they do not get the benefits that are supposed to come from Indian status. And so we look at that, and where I have people talking to me many times about, oh, special rights, it's the Indians who have special rights. I say the only ones who have special rights are the governments and organizations who have willfully gone into these areas where they do not have ownership, they have not been given permission to access these places, but they have gone in and literally stolen the resources, and they are selling them and making a profit. So when we go to court, we have a court that represents the thieves basically telling us, what can you say to say that the thieves are doing something incorrect when they are part of the system of thievery in the first place?
Now, you touched much earlier in the conversation on preserving, for example, the deer population. Mm-hmm. So the people, I think, locally are only seeing the one side where you are, for want of a better expression, culling the population in Short Hills. They're not seeing the other side of that equation, are they?
No.
So what do you say to them?
And that's been difficult, because again, every year the government turns around and offloads transfer payments to the provinces. And I have very seldom ever read people complaining or being upset with those transfer payments, other than the local officials who say Ottawa should have given us a little bit more. But when these transfer payments are given to Indian nations, all of a sudden there's a big uprising, and the comments that I read on the internet, the comments that I read in newspapers, the comments that I hear on the radio, comments that I hear all over are the most racist, ill-educated comments that I've ever heard. And I think it's the same thing when we talk about our people going in and harvesting some of the natural resources like deer and fish and things like that. These are things that were enshrined in our agreements that allowed the immigrant peoples to occupy and access our lands and territories through treaty. So if a treaty is not going to be upheld, then basically I believe we should turn around as Indian people and turn around and say, okay, no non-natives hunt in Canada whatsoever. We haven't done that. All we've said is, because we are the people that the original treaties were made with, that we have a priority to go in and hunt for our people, because we hunt for sustenance, we hunt for food, we hunt to help keep the deer populations down to where they're at a manageable level, to where they're not hurting the environment and they're not causing damage to people's homes, to people's gardens, to the grape industry, the wine industry, anything else that might be going, the fruit industry. These are things that have residual benefits that benefit everybody, because one group of people are honoring and respecting rights that were agreed to a long time ago. And if Canadians believe in one law for all people, like they say, all we have to say as Indian people is start following your own law then, and quit getting angry at us for following at ours, because ours is very much trying to work with all people rather than just a select few.
Before we run out of time, there is an article in the Globe and Mail that appeared a few days ago, which I found frightening, frankly, also quite interesting, and that's the inequality between education of Canadians and the First Nations people, and the absolutely astounding number of First Nations people who don't even have a high school education.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
We have communities that are pretty much isolated all on their own, where you have students that don't even have a school yet. These are agreements that were made, again, when we made these treaties, that we would allow access to our territories and lands by the Canadian government and individuals that were involved in mining, exploration, forestry, fishing, things like that, in exchange for goods and services, where the royalties would be shared with our people and we would receive these things from the government. So we have a young Aboriginal population that is growing and expanding at tremendous rates, but there just is not the government initiative or will to turn around and see that, I believe, to see that our people get education and educated in a good way. One of the things I also find that I struggle with is there's a United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People that spells out a way that our people should be able to approach the educational system in a way that respects our individuality, it respects our nationhood, respects who we are as different Aboriginal nations, and very few universities follow that. In fact, I teach classes here at Brock University, and I find it always interesting that I teach the way I was taught. I teach as an Indian. My classroom is structured in a totally different format. Every year, students tell me how much they love that format because it's totally different than what they experience with other professors. And it's not only offering education, but it's helping them to learn that through the educational process, how do we become a better person? And it's very hard for our people to enter these institutions that are really all about power and control and assimilating to become Canadian, rather than turning around and respecting our educational ways of learning. There's a process that I follow that I've told my students, using the moon cycles, because that's a traditional way of learning, where when you are going to read something or absorb information, you do that during certain moon cycles. And then there's other moon cycles where all you do is review. And in that way, you're not only learning information, you're retaining it. Actually, when you finish and have a degree, you actually remember half of what it was that you learned, rather than walking out and saying, well, I have a paper that has a thing on it saying I have a degree. Well, how much do you remember? Well, you know, I paid money, I wrote a lot of papers, read a lot of books, and I can tell you a little bit about it, but extensively, I just did what I had to do to get this degree. Whereas I find other people that have used this traditional form of education come out of the school, and my son is a good example. My son was asked to do a report in school. I worked with him using this moon cycle for education and learning, and he turned around, and because he has a different way of processing information, he gave his teacher a paper, and it was all had pictures on it, it had colors on it, it had all kinds of stuff. The teacher denied it, said it has to be black and white, no pictures, this and that and the other thing. I took my son to the principal's office because he had been suspended for telling the teacher, why can't you accept this? And they looked at him being disrespectful to the teacher, booted him out for several days. I took him back to the principal, and orally he stood in front of that principal and he told that principal the circumference of each of the planets that are in our solar system, the distance in light years that each one of them are from the sun, the distance in light years that each one of them are from the earth. Everything that he had written in that report, he told them orally over and over and over again, and they were blown away that a child that young had that amount of knowledge. And I said, that's because he has learned using ways in which the body functions naturally and associates itself and relates itself to the natural world, a system that was already set there for human beings learning.
The encouraging part of the report that I saw in the Globe and Mail, just to wrap things up, is the fact that a lot of the people, the First Nations people, are making the effort to get that education themselves, reinforcing what you just told us. They're not getting down. They're saying, look, we're going to find a way, and we're going to do this. That, to me, is very encouraging. That shows me First Nations people who are in this situation want a better life. They want a better lives, and this is how they're going about doing it.
Yeah. I've heard quite a few of our people turn around and say that when something happens in nature where we all of a sudden have a white buffalo showing up amongst our people, or in the paper lately, there was a big brouhaha over a white moose, an albino moose that was shot, and the hunters have apologized, saying they weren't aware it was a sacred animal. There's a lot of our people that have looked upon the day when a white buffalo returns, that is the day that our people will come back into prominence. And so many of our people, I've heard them say, education is the new white buffalo. Education is the sacred being that is going to get us and bring us back into prosperity of who we are, who we were created to be, and what we are here on this earth to do. And that's to continue this cycle of existence for not only us, but for seven generations of people yet coming.
Mr. Widrick, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Oh, nyawakoa.
That was Sakoyeta Widrick, a cultural awareness educator and traditionalist belonging to the Mohawk Wolf Clan, and a lecturer with the Tecumseh Center for Aboriginal Research and Education, with his views on First Nations issues up for discussion over the past week and ongoing as well. And this is Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. I'm your host, Mike Saunders. This coming Saturday at Rodman Hall Arts Center, Brock University will be hosting a one-day conference titled Public Space Urban Crisis. It will bring together architects, artists, urban specialists, city managers, and others to address issues of revitalization in post-industrial cities. The conference is open to the public and runs from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It will feature panel presentations under three main themes: urban space and architecture, food deserts, urban gardening movement and farmers markets, and the management of cities. The conference is funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and Brock University's Council for Research in the Social Sciences. Leah Bradshaw is a professor of political science at Brock and joined us in the studio earlier this week to talk about the conference in particular and revitalizing city centers in general. I asked what they hope to achieve with the conference.
Well, our objective was to bring together a sort of multiplicity of people. So on the program, we've got a variety of people. Some people talking about urban space and architecture. Some people talking about food deserts, urban gardening, farmers markets, and urban settings. Some people with a lot of experience and background in the management of cities, specifically in the Burlington-Hamilton area. And a couple of keynote speakers to sort of wind up the day. One, a political scientist from the University of Toronto who's written extensively about the integration of peoples in urban settings, and another person from York University, the Canada Research Chair, actually there in Cinema and Media Studies, who's going to talk about sort of artistic depictions of urban culture. So we've got a lot of different types of people involved in this one-day conference, but we've advertised the conference widely in the community. So my hope is that we will get a lot of people out from St. Catharines so that we have an integration of sort of the academic and intellectual community and people who live in St. Catharines, because the conference was really organized with a view to revitalization in this city. So that's my hope, that we get a lot of people out for this and that we have a kind of day-long conversation. The people who are presenting have been asked to keep their remarks to 15 minutes. And at the end of each panel, because we've actually got sort of four segments going through the day, we've left a lot of room for exchange between the audience and the presenters. So I really imagine this as a kind of day-long conversation among different kinds of people about urban revitalization.
So who are the speakers you're going to have there?
The speakers in the morning. The first panel is 9 o'clock in the morning. It's on urban space and architecture. We've got Adrian Blackwell coming, who is a professor of architecture at the University of Waterloo. He is also the editor of Scapegoat Magazine, a magazine on architectural landscapes and political economy. And your listeners can look this up if they like. Scapegoat is a very well-known publication out of Toronto on issues having to do with architecture and public space. Secondly, we have Michael Durow, who is from the School of Fine Arts and Creative Innovation at the University of Windsor. He is director of something called the Research Collective in Terminus, Media, Art, and Urban Ecologies. Somebody who is also interested in architecture and the configuration of public space. The first panel is really organized around people who are concerned with the aesthetics, if you like, of urban space. I mean, we all know that cities have been sort of gutted out, you know, the big box syndrome, shopping centers around the periphery, downtowns that have been imploding and collapsing and so on. So these are people who are interested in how you go about revitalizing the interiors of cities. And so they're interested in the aesthetics of that, what we do to make the downtown in the current setting an appealing place for people to come, how you get people to come back into the downtown core. So that's kind of what this first panel in the morning is about. We also have Derek Knight on that panel, who is the Brock University Chair in Creativity, Imagination, and Innovation. And Derek is the director of the Marilyn Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. And people in St. Catharines would certainly know about this because the Hair Cloth Company has been purchased in a collaborative venture between the City of St. Catharines and the university. That's a very exciting project. And we'll be home to the Faculty of Fine Arts at Brock University, but we'll also be a performing arts center. So this is exactly the kind of thing that I'm very enthusiastic about, because it brings together the university and the city in a way that I think benefits both of these constituencies. And finally on this panel in the morning, we have Ingrid Macus, who is the Dean of Social Science at Brock University. And she is going to be talking specifically about an art installation in Europe that she thought was very interesting and may have relevance for revitalization in St. Catharines. So that panel is at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it goes until 10:15, and it is specifically on urban space and architecture. People, by the way, can just drop in for any of these panels that they might be interested. They don't have to stay for the whole day. The second panel is at 9:45 in the morning, Food Deserts, Urban Gardening, and Farmers Markets. There is a burgeoning body of literature now among people working in the social sciences, particularly in the university, about what we call the food deserts in inner cities. Again, it's the problem that these big box stores have moved to the periphery of the city. People who are mobile, who have cars, who are affluent, particularly, have no problem accessing these places. But people who live in the inner city core, many of whom maybe don't drive, we think particularly about the old, the infirm, and so on, who live in inner city cores, they have no access to food. St. Catharines is a prime example. I mean, there's no grocery store in downtown St. Catharines. There are a number of facilities. Giant Tiger, for example, sells food and so on. And there, of course, is a fabulous farmer's market. And we're very lucky to have that. That's open 3 days a week, features a lot of local produce, and it's a wonderful, wonderful space. But not all cities have that. And the market, of course, is open only 3 days a week. So there's this problem of what we call the food desert. Their high quality food is not available to people who live in inner cities. So we've got a panel going at 10:45 a.m. on this question. The first speaker is Jan Campbell Luxton. He owns De La Terre Bakery in Vineland, which is an organic bakery. He is at the market with his breads and his baked goods, the farmer's market in St. Catharines. But Jan actually has a background in sociology, so he's very interested in issues of the distribution of food. He's not just a baker. He's actually very engaged in these kinds of issues, and I believe he has recently purchased a farm in which he plans to grow some of his own ingredients for his food. So actually, I should pronounce his name properly, Jan. It's Jan Campbell Luxton, owner of De La Terre Bakery. We also have Kevin Roy and Sarah Oldenberger of Geography at the University of Toronto. These two, along with two other collaborators who are not coming to the conference, two of the four are coming, produced a report last year, a food desert siting report for the city of Hamilton, in which they actually went in and made prescriptions for where one might locate farmers markets in the Hamilton area that they predicted would be successful. That report has been picked up by the city of Hamilton and is under scrutiny right now. So they're going to come and talk about this problem in Hamilton, which I gather is even more acute than it is in St. Catharines. And finally, we have Grant Yoakum, who is from the Interdisciplinary interdisciplinary program in the humanities at Brock University, president of the Windsor Philosophic Arts Association. And he is going to talk about artist collectives and urban gardening movements, specifically in the Detroit-Windsor area. I just visited Detroit recently. I had never been there. It's pretty shocking. Detroit was, at one point in the 1950s, the most wealthy city in North America, built around the car industry. It's really a decimated place. I think there are, if I'm not wrong, there are 750,000 people living in inner city Detroit, compared to 2.5 million at its peak. And it was built around the car industry, and we all know what's happened. Again, there's a very strong parallel with Hamilton and St. Catharines and Windsor. So this is kind of the axis that we're looking at in this conference: Detroit, Windsor, St. Catharines, Hamilton. Anyway, there's some really exciting things happening in Detroit. I visited the farmers market there, which is really fantastic. And there's also a really exciting art project there called the Heidelberg Project. Someone who was born and raised in Detroit came back to a neighborhood that was completely deracinated. I mean, boarded up, overgrown, nobody living there, more than 20 years ago. And he sort of squatted there with his friends, and they built an artist collective, a very famous project now called the Heidelberg Project, and we visited that. That was very exciting too. So Grant will speak to these revitalization movements in Detroit. So that panel is at 10:45, just to repeat this, and goes for about an hour and a half. At 1:30 in the afternoon, we have a panel on the management of cities. I have to acknowledge the assistance here of my colleague David Siegel. I teach in the Department of Political Science. Dave Siegel is a professor of public administration in the department, and he is the director of the Niagara Community Observatory. And Dave really put together this panel for me with contacts that he has. Michael Fenn is coming. He is the former Deputy Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing for the Province of Ontario and the founding Chief Executive Officer of Metrolinx. If anyone knows about Metrolinx, it's been in the news a lot lately. So he has extensive background in issues of transportation and the integration of cities, and he will be speaking to that. Secondly, on that panel, we have Vic Johal, who is the Director of Government Relations and Legislative Services for AMCTO in Waterloo. Again, this is a contact of Dave Siegel, and he has extensive, again, bureaucratic experience in forging links between government and cities. And finally, we have Bruce Krushelnicki, someone that I know from my early days at Brock. He was a professor at Brock University, but then he left the university for a career in urban planning. He is currently the director of planning for the city of Burlington. So this is exciting, too. I don't know if anyone locally has been to Burlington recently, but they've done amazing things in that city, and they've got a beautiful waterfront and a very vibrant kind of thing going in urban Burlington. So I'm sure that Bruce will have some interesting things to contribute to this conference. And finally, Dave Siegel himself, who is director of the Niagara Community Observatory and has been heavily involved in issues of revitalization in St. Catharines. So that is the management panel. And then finally, at 3:15 in the afternoon, we have two keynote speakers. Margaret Cohen from Political Science at the University of Toronto. She's written extensively on issues of urban space and particularly the integration of neighborhoods. You know, one of the really serious problems in cities is ghettoization, where people segregate themselves into separate constituencies. And a particular problem is the affluent who move into so-called gated communities, isolating themselves from the diversity of the city. And the city becomes, in some ways, a place that is inhospitable and too expensive for the diversity of people that you actually want living in the city. So Margaret has addressed these issues. She's the author of two books. I'll just give you the titles: Radical Space, Building the House of the People, and another book, Brave New Neighborhoods, The Privatization of Public Space. One of the issues that we want to address in this conference, and clearly I have a commitment to this, is the preservation of public space. And by that we mean it could be parks, it could be artists' initiatives, it can even be shopping centers, but places that people have access to across all groups and all the diversity of people that live in the city. So what you really want to do in a vibrant public space is you want to prevent as far as possible the enclosure of private spaces, private properties that people don't have access to. So Margaret will address this. And finally, we have Janine Marchessault of Cinema and Media Studies at York University. She's the author of a recent book titled Cartographies of Place. So she's very interested in issues of public space as well, but more from the perspective of an artist. and then a political scientist. I put on the poster that I circulated around, she was the co-curator of the Nuit Blanche Monumental Project, titled Museum for the End of the World at Nathan Phillips Square. Listeners may know about the Nuit Blanche Project. This just happened in Toronto, I think it was last weekend, but it's an annual project in Toronto. It's a night-long festival where people present, oh, there's all kinds of stuff. There's art, performance art, music, and so on. It's an all-night festival. It's a huge success. So she's been heavily involved in that. And the respondent to the keynotes is Stefan Dolgert, who's a colleague of mine in political science at Brock University, just recently arrived, actually, last year. And Stefan is a political theorist. That's actually my background as well. He's a political theorist, but he is very interested in these kinds of questions, and he will field the response from the audience from these two keynote speakers. So that's our day. It begins at 9, ends at 5. But as I said, there are really four discrete sessions going on different topics, and so we welcome anyone who wants to drop in for any part of it.
Yeah, it's open to the public and free.
It's open to the public, and it's free, and it's in beautiful Rodman Hall in downtown St. Catharines.
One of the great architectural designs in downtown St.
Catharines. It is. It's an absolutely... I was so thrilled when Brock acquired this building because I just think it's magnificent. So it's a great place to have this conference.
Now, in a nutshell, what is the urban crisis that cities such as St. Catharines, and I'm thinking also Welland and Niagara Falls,
yes,
are facing today? Is it really coming down to getting people to live in the city center? People for years now have moved out to so-called the burbs, and we're left with a wasteland in downtown cities all across, like you mentioned, Detroit. There's so many abandoned houses that people have just given up, for example, in Detroit. Is that the real problem that we're facing now?
The problem is, it's a much bigger demographic than that. I think the problem is, and as I said, our axis in this conference has been sort of St. Catharines, Windsor, Detroit, Hamilton. These are all what we call post-industrial cities. These are cities that were built around the automotive industry at a time in which industrial expansion was really blossoming. And we all know what's happened in these communities. The auto industry has fled. We live in what we call a post-industrial culture. I said this is a kind of a global phenomenon where production and manufacturing generally has shifted to the developing world because labor costs are cheaper and corporations have moved out of constituencies where the labor costs and the production costs are high. This is kind of the background to the problems in these former industrial cities. So what has happened is that you're left with an inner city core. I mean, when I look back on the way that, you know, I lived in City Street in St. Catharines for a long, long time, adjacent to the old GM plant, with these houses that are right on the street, very close together, fabulous neighborhood. And speaking to some of the retired GM workers that live on that street still, they said, you know, they left high school, they got a job in GM, they lived in those houses, and they walked back and forth to work. So there was a community there of people. They lived there, they work there, their kids played on the hockey teams. There's an arena on Hague Street. The kids played hockey there. There was a whole community. That was a wonderful thing in a way. And I think part of what we see is now is an effort to reconstitute. How can we capture that in some way, that people will have this commitment to the community and that they will live and thrive in a space where they can work and live and shop and entertain themselves? There's a famous urban theorist in Toronto, she's dead now, but named Jane Jacobs, who wrote a lot about cities, and she had a formula for vibrant urban living, and she said you need three things. You need employment in the inner city core. You need housing in the inner city core, and a plurality of housing so that people in all income brackets can live in the inner city and that they want to live in the inner city. And you need the arts so that people will be drawn to the city. So you need those three things. And finally, generally speaking, which may go contrary to common sense in some ways, I always have a hard time getting this point across, well, in some quarters anyway, you need congestion. Really, cities thrive on congestion. If you think about healthy cities, and they tend to be these big urban spaces now, but not always. I mean, there are elements of this in St. Catharines, I think, that are very encouraging. But if you go into downtown Toronto in some of these inner city neighborhoods, right, where people live in the city, you know, they live over stores, they live in apartments. The streets are full of grocery stores, bakeries, cafes, and people live there. They shop there, they work there, they walk, there are parks. That's the kind of thing that makes for a vibrant urban city. I think there's a reverse migration now. You know, you mentioned St. Catharines and what happened in St. Catharines. It's absolutely true. I think there was a time, probably based on the car, based on the automotive industry, based on the way that people were living, that they wanted vast expanses of private space where they could move out in places where they had solitude, where they had privacy. I think it may have to do with demographics, too. You know, the population of the Niagara region is increasingly old. There are a lot of retirees here. You know, people who are getting toward the end of their life don't want to live out in the suburbs all by themselves. They want to live in places where there's some action, where things are proximate, where they can shop, where they can see people, where there's diversity.
And a sense of community, like in the neighborhood, Central St. Catharines, where you yourself lived.
Yes.
You know the people. You know your neighbors.
Yes, you know your neighbors. I'll give you an example. I mean, I don't know if you want to hear these sort of examples. I remember years and years ago, I lived in downtown St. Catharines, and the old YMCA building housed a daycare. And the building was torn down, which I think is a travesty. That was a magnificent old building. And the new YMCA was built out by the Fairview Mall. Of course, it's a fabulous facility. They had all kinds of things possible in their running tracks and so on, which they couldn't build in the downtown YMCA. But what I remember from that, there's terrible loss when you change these kinds of venues. So I had a daughter in daycare at the YMCA. And every day they would take these young children out, you know, how they tie them all in a rope and walk them around downtown St. Catharines. Well, what I remember is going on one of those walks, and at every corner along that route, in the morning and again in the afternoon, there would be all these elderly people sitting on benches waiting for those children. So when I think about that, I think about the loss, you know what I mean? The community loss that happens when these kinds of facilities leave. And the goal is efficiency. And the goal is really to provide facilities, as I said, for the mobile and the affluent. So there's definitely a social justice element to trying to build inner city communities.
This is a big subject for me.
Yes.
And I got so much I want to talk to you about. Would you come back again?
I will come back. I'd be delighted. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Leah Bradshaw is a professor of political science at Brock, and their conference, Public Space Urban Crisis, comes up this Saturday at Rodman Hall, 9 to 5. A lot of speakers, and the public is welcome to attend. It's free of charge, and we'll see you there. Leah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And indeed, Professor Bradshaw will return next week as we continue with part two of our discussion on urban problems many Canadian cities now face as they try to reinvent their city centers. The conference comes up at Rodman Hall on Saturday, and we hope you'll be there. Should be an exciting event. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. The next.